From the George Ignatieff Theatre at the University of Toronto, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. Her talks are being broadcast each night this week on Ideas and are called The Real World of Technology. Dr. Franklin is an experimental physicist, professor emeritus of metallurgy at the University of Toronto, and the only woman there ever to have held the title University Professor. She's a former board member of the National Research Council and the Science Council of Canada. She's a fellow of the Royal Society and an officer of the Order of Canada. In these Massey lectures, Dr. Franklin is discussing technology not as gadgets, but rather as a whole set of social and cultural arrangements characterized by production-based rules for social control, by pervasive mechanization, by mass production with rigid divisions of labor, and by an associated political mindset, all bundled together into a single social system. Her focus is on what it means to live in this real world of technology. Ursula Franklin.
Thanks a lot. I had in every one of these lectures stressed that the division of labor that is so characteristic for the prescriptive technologies that I described has resulted in acculturation of people into a culture of conformity and compliance. And that, as I pointed out, has many very significant consequences. Ivan Illich pointed out in one of his masterly essays called Shadow Work, which was published in 1981, that the prescriptive technologies, particularly those that are transferred to administrative and social services, produce the desired results only when the clients, that is, the parents, the students, the patients, comply faithfully and to the letter with the prescriptions of the system. Thus, the advanced applications of prescriptive technology require not only the compliance of the workers, but also the compliance of those who use the technologies or being processed by it. And Illich stressed that role of individuals in this compliance. In my discussions on the publicly funded infrastructures that support technology, I have pointed out that not only do individuals have to fit into the compliance scheme, but so do governments and public institutions. All social interactions proceed according to certain characteristic internal logics. Now, as prescriptive technologies structure more and more social interactions, they carry with them the logic of technology, the logic of production. And consequently, as our interactions are more and more conducted via these prescriptive technologies, the logic of technology tends to overpower and displace all other social logics, such as the logic of compassion, the logic of obligation, the logic of ecological survival, or the logic of linking to nature. And Herbert Marcuse called this overpowering to our attention in his work on the one-dimensional man. In order to address the question of the mechanisms by which the logic of technology suffocates other forms of social knowledge, I want to look at the patterns of introduction of different technologies into society. And that's a historical view, and you will see that there are different patterns. They are somewhat chronological, and this is why I was first thinking I'd call that the three ages of technology. But then it sounded a bit glib to me. There is, however, a sequence and a pattern. Historians of technology tell us that there is a pattern that always goes from an invention that might develop a device or machinery. This, when it's accepted in a society, leads to growth of a particular technology, to standardization of the device, to consolidation of the design, and too often economic consolidation. In that process, the technology can very often then stagnate, no new inventions come forward, and there is no longer any creative change. And we've seen that, for instance, in the case of the automobile. Now, one can look at that same process of invention, growth, acceptance, stagnation, and standardization from the other end of the telescope, from the end of the society that accepts it. And that, to my mind, is a much richer picture, because at the point of invention, there's usually a great deal of enthusiasm and imagination. There are efforts to explore and explain just how wonderful and helpful the new invention will be. And science fiction has often cut the path, the dreams of flight, of fast private transportation, the expectance of instant communications, of helpful machines. All these stress, liberation from hard physical labor at work and drudgery at home, they are wellsprings of creativity and freedom from toil, all just around the corner. And at that phase, technology creates human bonds and a sense of excitement in people. People feel grateful to be part of such wonderful advancing times. And the voices of reservation sound like disgruntled skepticism, fearful of change, like the old lady who said that if God had wanted us to fly, she would have never given us the railways. During the Industrial Revolution, one was in such phase of exuberant expectations. There were odes to the steam engine. And the great exhibitions around the turn of the century depicted a much better and more exciting life, almost within the reach of ordinary people. During this phase of youthful exuberance, the technologies achieve a generally and broadly based entry into the public mind and into the public imagination. Yes, people think, indeed, it would be nice to try out a car, a telephone, or to work with one of these fancy machines. And soon after this phase of imagination, human contact, and hope, a new phase appears. It is somehow the phase of the stern father who says, "What do you really want to be when you grow up?" This is a phase of growth and standardization. People, workers, and users become much less involved in the technology itself. Take, for instance, the automobile. In its young phase, it was quite appropriately called the mechanical bride. The phrase was used by Marshall McLuhan to describe the relationship between the car and the owner. At that time, care was lavished by young men on their automobiles. They would polish and tune them, repair them, and improve their performance. There was a sense of friendship among them, and they could admire each other's mechanical brides. There's little left of this today. In the car's technological middle age, it is hard, if not impossible, to repair one's own vehicle, other than by taking out interchangeable part and popping in identical replacements. Cars are now costly to buy and to maintain, and for many, owning a car is neither a joy nor a luxury. It has become a necessity. The mechanical bride has long since turned into a demanding but essential business partner. The technological standardization of cars has occurred, and with them, the elimination of the user's access to the machine itself. At the same time, the infrastructures that used to serve those who did not use a car atrophied and vanished. Some may say they were starved to death. Railways gave way to more and more roadways, and thus a technology that had been perceived as liberating its users began to enslave them. The real joy of owning wheels, that sense of independence of the driver who knew that they could go anywhere, whenever they wanted, wherever they wanted, became muted, because in reality there were usually thousands and thousands of others who wanted or had to go to the same place at the same time. In the early phases of a technology, it often operates in a take-it-or-leave-it mode. The user is involved, the user has a feeling of control. But when a technology and its infrastructure becomes institutionalized, the users become captive supporters of both the infrastructure and the technology. And at this point, the technology itself may stagnate. Improvements may become cosmetic or marginal, and competition may become ritual. When one assesses the impact of particular technologies, these internal chronologies, these three ages of technology, need to be considered within my own lifetime. It were not only cars, but also audio equipment that went through a youthful and involved phase where people were talking about matching impedances, they were building preamps from kits, they were testing turntables and comparing their respective successes in achieving high fidelity sound reproduction. That phase is gone too. The markets now of a standard plug-in equipment, and the owners can listen and not intervene beyond pushing buttons. And we are in the middle of a youthful evolution if we look at the use of computers. Today's popular and emotional involvement is with a personal computer, and it is quite akin to the phase of the mechanical bride. Once again, there's a promise of liberation. There's no need anymore for good typing skills, for correct spelling, for arithmetic, or knowing how to do percentages. No need to keep files straight. The computer can do it all. One can even recycle that painful letter to Aunt Agatha, to other members of the family, with very minor alterations. And the manufacturers and promoters stress the liberating attributes of a new technology, regardless of the specific technology in question. There are always attempts to allay fear, be user-friendly, let the user derive pride from their new skills. There's an effort to build user communities, brimming over with warm feelings of sharing newly won expertise. The best barometer for these endeavors in the computing field are now the large numbers of popular computing magazines. They range from the free of charge stuff, such as Toronto Computes, to the glossy ones you buy in a bookstore like PC World, but all of them have very similar styles, based on that gushy, breathtaking, gee-whiz kind of journalism. And they remind me of nothing so much as the women's magazines that one used to pick up in great numbers at the supermarkets when fancy kitchen appliances and prepared foods were being introduced. There, too, were coupons and free gifts, recipe exchanges, and user-proven tips for shortcuts or special effects. And I urge you to go and look at some of those computer magazines from the point of view of get up and style. And you find features on how I found 10 more uses for Lotus 1-2-3, or how I extended the capacity of my Mac beyond imagination. And these contributions remind me very strongly of features such as how I used packaged cake mix and even my mother-in-law didn't notice it. Now, you may question the validity of this analogy and say, is there really any correspondence between the ways in which prepared and packaged food was introduced in the marketplace and the marketing of computers? And I would think, yes, there is. And my argument goes as follows. Let's look first at food. In the post-war period, there were considerable advances in the chemistry of food additives. These allowed for much longer shelf life in the products to which these chemicals had been added. At the same time, machinery made individual packaging of goods economically viable, and as a third point, distribution systems, particularly by air, opened up. So foodstuff could be chemically stabilized, industrially packaged, and commercially shipped over long distances. And the challenge to advertising and marketing was to stimulate and entice changes in cooking and eating habits that would utilize the new products and the appliances that would go with them. And so the chain of evidence goes from Betty Crocker and her recipes to magazines and gadgets to frozen foods and TV dinners to today's attempts to market irradiated food or infant formulas in the third world. The promotion of industrially processed food was geared to make women accept these new products as liberating and exciting additions to their families' lives without worrying about the chemical additives or about the increasing price. And I see a very similar scenario in the promotion of computers for individual use, and I think that pitch is quite deliberate. It aims at creating an atmosphere of harmless domesticity around the new technology in order to ease its acceptance. Who, indeed, would fear these cute and clever things that make life so interesting at home when the kids play games on them? There's also the language of the computers to support this image of harmless domesticity. One speaks of booting up and boilerplate, talks about mouse and menu. And the Euler had the feeling of choice and control, of mastery, and of a comfortable relationship with the machine and with other users. But this phase will not last. Behind that pink fluff is already the feature of a global industrial restructuring. The changes in the workplace are there, and you know that it will not be the worker who will exercise control. So after you looked at the computer magazines, I urge you to read Heather Menzies' new book called Fast Forward and Out of Control, where she speaks about the global restructuring in terms of Canadian economics and Canadian workers. And it's quite clear that if one does not watch, and particularly does not watch the infrastructures that eliminate alternatives, the promise of liberation through technology can become a ticket to enslavement. I would just like to remind you of a classic example of the doubtful promise of liberation of a new technology, because the case is focused, direct, and drastic. It's the introduction of the sewing machine. In 1851, mechanical sewing machines became commercially available devices. They were widely advertised as household appliances that would free women from the chores and drudgery of hand sewing. Whether women sewed at home for their own use or were seamstresses working for others, the promise was liberation from toil. Not only were individual women to benefit from the new devices, but there were high hopes for humanity as a whole. I want to read you a paragraph that was quoted by Therese Cameray in an article on the history of the sewing machine, written in 1860. And it goes like this. The sewing machine will, after some time, effectively banish ragged and unclad humanity from every class. These machines are now in operation and do or may do 100 times more towards clothing the indigent and feeble than the united fingers of all the charitable and willing ladies collected through the civilized world could possibly perform. That was, as I said, 1860. But what actually happened, of course, was not like this at all. Though machines were indeed used in households and became part of home furnishing, the major development was their use in a factory setting. The resulting sweatshops exploited the labor of women, and particularly of immigrant women. Sewing machines became, in fact, synonymous not with liberation, but with exploitation. Cheap machine-sewn household goods and garments became readily available on the mass market. And the garments were produced in prescriptive technologies in which one seamstress would sew up sleeves, another would put them in, another would make the buttonholes, another would iron the shirt. It was a strictly prescriptive technology in the classical sense. And today, of course, much of the designing, cutting, and execution of garments is automated, often to the complete elimination of workers. And the social history of the industrialization of clothing resonates with the current phase of the industrialization of eating. Food outlets produce frozen or chemically prepared meal units that go together like the sleeves and collars on the shirts. They are Mac jobs, and there's no security in them at all. And indeed, women cook less, sew less, and they have to work very hard outside the home in most cases to be able to buy food and clothing. What has turned promised liberation into enslavement is not the products of technology per se, the car, the computer, the sewing machine, but the structures and infrastructures that are put in place to facilitate their use and develop dependence on them. And the funny thing in this development is that in the course of spreading technology, the ordinary things, the home-cooked meal, the individually made garment, become priced and precious and special. While what would have been priced and extraordinary, such as clothes or fruit from the Orient, appears now quite ordinary and routine. So I'd like to recap that many new technologies and their products have entered the public sphere in a cloud of hope, imagination, and anticipation. In many cases, these hopes were fictional to begin with rather than real, and even in the best of circumstances, they were rather exaggerated. They all focused on individual users, were they owners or workers, and promised them liberation from toil and drudgery. They never focused on the effects of the use of the same device by a very large number of people, nor did they focus on the institutional, organizational, and industrial application of the new technology, other than in the vaguest of terms. In spite of that exaggerated individual promise, the techniques were treated as if they would fit easily into what would be quote-unquote normal life. But once the technology is standardized and accepted, the relationship between the products of that technology and the users change. The users have much less scope, they matter less, and their needs are no longer the chief concern of the designer. It should be evident by now that there is no such thing as introducing one gadget to do a particular task. It is foolish to assume that everything else in such a situation would remain the same. All things change when one thing changes. Even the introduction of a dishwasher into a family's life changes the way in which members of the family work together, changes the expectations of each other. I'd now like to talk about one of my favorite subjects, women and technology. It's a very active topic of discussion and research in today's world of technology. And during the past decades, scholars, particularly feminist scholars, have collected a great deal of new information on the contribution that women have made indeed to the development of particular knowledge, particular technologies, and they have shown documented very many of these significant contributions. There's also fresh insight into the impact of particularly modern technology on women workers. These technologies have cemented at any given time the then existing power relationships, and those power relationships have usually been male and hierarchical. We've seen, when I discussed the example of the Parkway system of Robert Moses, the technological packaging of racial and class bias. there's also a lot of technological packaging of gender bias. In the first lecture, I pointed out how technology as practice can define what is a legitimate context and who are legitimate practitioners. The perceived gendering of tools and professions can lead to strong biases against women, biases that may be personal as well as institutional. And many scholars, like Cynthia Cockburn, Sally Hacker, Margaret Benston, have documented these biases and their consequences. There are also many other features that make the entry of women into technological work difficult. But the most powerful obstacle, in my opinion, is a fragmentation of the technical work and the rigid hierarchical structures. And that means the prescriptive technologies themselves. In 1984, I published a paper called "Will Technology Change Women or Will Women Change Technology?" I addressed this question of technological structuring of knowledge and work, as I've done in these lectures. And I contrasted the prescriptive technologies to the women's historical experience of situational and holistic work. And the success of such holistic women's work depends strongly on personal judgment, on knowledge of the total work process, and on the ability to discern what are essential variables at any one time. None of these, neither the discernment, nor the complete judgment, nor the knowledge of previous similar cases, are required in modern industrial production, and indeed, they are often not appreciated in workers. These are nevertheless the skills and strengths that women very often bring to the workplace. In the paper, I've argued that it is pointless to bring women into the jobs in the real world of technology merely to work within the existing technological mode. The great contribution of women to technology lies precisely in their potential to change the technological structures by their understanding, critiquing, and changing those parameters that have kept women away from technology. Only then can one have the possibility of changing the real world of technology itself. Now, happily, I see small beginnings of such structural changes. Work environments that are less prescriptive, workplaces that are less hierarchical, relations that are less rigid. However, it's only a very small start. And still today, in the real world, women are most likely to succeed if they become one of the boys as quickly as they can. And I think that's one something that is very close to my heart, that one does not deny women the opportunity to practice technology differently. And that, on the level of the universities, goes down to money and promotion and granting structures, to allowing women to do things differently as well as to do different things. And I see at the moment this as one of the very major obstacles, not an obstacle for women who wish to be like men, but a real obstacle for women who do not wish to be like men and still be engineers, be scientists. The institutional obstacles are still tremendous because they relate to technology as practice. And it is there that I see the growing edge of change, because no change will come if we don't change the practice. But I now need to come back to the role of women as workers and their contribution to the spread and development of technology. Because it's important to me to establish how much the work of women has contributed to the establishment of particular technologies. I think it's entirely fair to say that without the work of women, their willingness to do extremely delicate but repetitive jobs, their abilities to learn intricate work patterns, the electrical and electronic technologies in particular, would not have been developed in the way they actually did. It has often been stressed how poorly women were paid in the new technological order, but it has been stressed much less how essential women's skill and perseverance has been for the development of the same technologies. And you see that both in the history of electrical equipment, you see it in the transfer of mechanical equipment to the office. Who but women would have coped with the first monsters of mechanical typewriters? But one of the politically most interesting interface between women and technology is the role of the telephone operator. Because in the early days, telephone operators had a much larger task than just connecting wires through a switchboard. And telephone operators, in contrast to engineers, were always women. Carol Marvin of the University of Pennsylvania published in 1988 a very insightful and original book depicting the reactions of both the general population and the business community to the introduction at the turn of the century of electrical technologies ranging from electrical lights to telegraph and telephones. And she called her book When Old Technologies Were New. It documents very nicely that interplay between technology and the changes in social relations. What becomes from there and other accounts quite clear is that in order to make the electrical technologies, particularly the telephone, work at all, it was necessary to find and explore the appropriate uses for that telephone system and establish them as part of normal living and doing business. And the telephone operator was the link that made this technology work. And let me stress again that the operator was not a mechanical or an electric link, it was a human link. The telephone operators provided the operational centers that directed the technology as much as it facilitated the application. The operators were the ones who found out the ways to make that technology work and could signal the ones that didn't. They were, in fact, what we would today call product development engineers. And in the early stages of this development, many telephone switchboards were also telegraph stations, so that in 1890, for instance, the results of the U.S. presidential elections were telegraphed to switchboards, and from there the operator gave the subscribers every hour on the hour election results. At the same time, telephone subscribers could phone in for recent sport results. Telephone operators could take and relay messages, and they linked up with other operators. In fact, you could have a conference call in 1890. There's a very nice story in Carolyn Marvin's book on operators, telephone operators in five U.S. cities linking up with each other to play music and sing together in a concert for their subscribers. The telephone very much provided more than two-way communications. There's a story of a reporter in a sports field who described an important match at the turn of the century, and the phone brought back the cheers and boos of those who listened on that giant party line, and it was said that there were more than 1,000 people hearing at the same time about this match. In fact, events were broadcast, quote unquote, over the telephone well before the wireless existed. In Paris, at the turn of the century, one could, for 5 centimes, listen to half an hour of the opera or hear half an hour of a play during that performance. So if you were very keen on the aria in the middle of the second act, you could, in fact, invest 5 centimes to hear that on the telephone. There were telephone services very much equivalent to our radio broadcasts, regularly scheduled formal affairs with news, weather, commentary, music. Particularly for some reason in Hungary, there was a telephone Hermando, if my Hungarian is right, that had something that could very well be your local station today, starting with the exact time, the weather, the latest business news, going to an evening at the opera toward the end of the day and a suitable prayer. In the States, there was one similar operation, the Telephone Herald of Newark in 1911. It had within a month 1,000 subscribers and something like 25,000 during their first 3 months. In fact, it choked on its own success. Not enough telephones could be installed quickly enough. But to come back to the operator, during this phase, in which the various applications of telephone and telegraph communication were developed and tested, the operators were central participants. One could at that time not imagine the telephone working without an operator. Once the development and the social integration of the technology had been completed to the satisfaction of their promoters, once the infrastructures of need had been established, the technology began to eliminate its human links. Switchboards were redesigned, automated, and the operators were slowly supplanted by sophisticated equipment. But together with the human links, the community use of the telephone disappeared. And today we are still busy inventing and selling devices to take on some of the functions of the operators. We have answering machines and scheduling devices on our telephone. We try, sometimes unsuccessfully, to electronically transfer calls within our own organization. But what happens now in our telephone system are one-way communications. We may be able to receive a weather report by telephone, but you can't say to the recorded announcement, "Are you sure? I think it looks like rain to me." The phone and radio programs that we get are at best one-to-one communications. You can participate in that one-to-one communication, but not cheer or boo when somebody else says something, as those guys could with the football report. So it is a very different technology, a technology that has eliminated in most ways its community use. There are, of course, times when the one-to-one, the strict one-to-one communication where nobody listens is very important. It can be essential and life-saving, as the distress lines that are kept busy in many of our big cities manifest. There are these cases. But there are also telephone technologies that have in many ways brought us the ultimate parody of electronic non-communications. And this is how it's advertised. And this is, of course, advertised on television. And I read, the two best places in town to meet fun and exciting people for friendship, romance, and fun, it's a dating game. Listen to personal calls, send and receive messages instantly over your touch button phone. Call 1-976-9595. Or another, in the mood for a party, want to meet new friends, or perhaps that special someone, call the party line, 1-976-8585, the dating game, the party line, $3 per call, toll fee, if any. These lines are apparently very popular with young people, affluent young people, I would say, at $3 a call, and the call is less than 3 minutes. And I'm told many of them just listen in, and even in the party line where they could talk to others, don't do so. And I think at this point, we should stop and think. This is part of the real world of technology, this 976 line. What does it say about a society when human needs for fellowship and warmth are met by devices that provide illusions to the users and profit for the suppliers? And the reason why I find this particular application upsetting is, as a response to loneliness, it seems to me deceitful and fraudulent. There are no shortcuts to the investment of time and care in friendship and in human relations. And it is fraudulent to pretend otherwise. It's also the individual's need to be needed. And this need to be needed is among those things that make us human. But the need to be needed becomes less and less as a consequence of the type of technology that this world has fostered. And I think when human loneliness is a source of income through devices, we better stop and think, what are we doing? And I think that it is there that I'd like to close, because I think when we look at this real world of technology and how we can conduct ourselves as human beings responsibly and compassionately and intelligently, then we see a number of very real tasks, both within our communities, within the relationship between people, but also within the relationship of our community with nature and the things that are happening there. As I said at the very beginning of these lectures, I do feel quite strongly, and you don't need to share that feeling, that we have come to the end of a historical period in which technology was helpful and useful to meet human needs over the last 200-300 years. Kenneth Boulding once said, "Nothing fails as well as success." And in that he meant that one risks failure when something that works is carried on beyond the point of its appropriate usefulness. And I think in terms of technology, we have come to that point. And I would like, in the last lecture, to summarize a few of the highlights of the preceding five, and then run past you, and that is all I can do, thoughts of where I think this real world of technology has to go, and what we as individuals have to do in order to make the real world of technology into a livable human habitat for all. Thank you.
Tonight on Ideas, you've heard the fourth of the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. This series, called The Real World of Technology, continues tomorrow. The lectures will be repeated at the end of March on Ideas in 6 installments as they were originally delivered. And at that time, an expanded version will be available as a book published by the CBC in conjunction with the University of Toronto Press. Tonight's broadcast was produced by Max Allen, with Bernie Lucht, Lon Tulk, and Gail Brownell. I'm Lister Sinclair. Thank you.